with the matter of worldliness. When we think about worldliness, what usually comes to mind? If you say that we need to make sure that we're not guilty of worldliness, what comes to mind?
Evil.
Do what? What causes worldliness? What usually attached to this worldliness?
Sin.
Sin. The what?
Life without God.
Okay. So, in reference to that, usually, well, I'll not even go there. One of the things that we have, and I will, but it'll be in a matter, sometimes the tendency to consider material possessions or physical comfort is an indicator of worldliness. And so it usually, a lot of times when lessons are taught on it, they'll couple worldliness and materialism together, as if materialism is a part of worldliness. And so that if it's a matter of where, as it's defined, it is a tendency to consider material possessions and physical comfort as is more important than spiritual values. Whereas the world focuses on the life that now is, while godliness focuses on that which is to come. Okay, true statement. Right? That we understand that our spiritual needs take precedence over that of the physical, worldly needs of what we have. But the problem with this is that sometimes that'll get brought over. Kind of like with the Jews. They were told not to boil their kids in their mother's milk. Right? It was an idolatrous practice, and that's the reason they were told that. But you know what the Jews did with it? You know what they did with that command? Bob Joe?
They separated the dairy from the meat. They have totally different kitchens for each. They can't touch each other.
Can't touch each other. You can't have a cheeseburger.
Or a pizza.
Because you cannot join the two. Now, some of the liberals within the Jewish nation, you have to separate, you know, like maybe 10 minutes after you've had the meat, you can have the dairy. But in order, you can't eat it, and you can't mix them on the same plate. You cannot use a dairy knife, on meat. So they take something that the Lord has given, and then they shove it to the other end of the spectrum and abuse, actually, and miss the point of what's being stated. There's no doubt that our spiritual well-being is to supersede that of our physical aspects, because the physical is going to pass away. The spiritual is not. One is temporal, the other is eternal. But we find that in regards to the possessions that we have, or whatever the case is, that God has given us them as a reward, if you will. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 23. We find where Solomon said, "Be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks, and look well to thy herds. For riches are not forever, and doth the crown endure unto all generations? The hay is carried, and the tender grass showeth itself, and the herbs of the mountain are gathered in. The lambs are for thy clothing, and the goats are the price of the field. And there will be goat's milk enough for thy food, for the food of thy household, and maintenance for thy maidens." And we understand that there's maintenance with life. What happened the last time you went down and you filled up your automobile with fuel? Did that give you kind of an idea of where the economy is and how much it costs just to get across town? Whatever the case may be. We understand that money is required in our society. And we find that it is a part of what God has provided for us. The writing of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We'll just look at some passages here of what Solomon had to say concerning that of wealth or the obtaining of monies, if you will. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 13, "And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor is the gift of God." God allows us and expects us to be able to function, to be able to work, to be able to have income, if you will, even to enjoy that. Chapter 5 and verse 19.
We find that where Solomon said, every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. And he said, so I give you riches, I give you wealth, that you might enjoy it, that it is a gift of God. Chapter 9, verse 7. Solomon said, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God hath already accepted thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let not thy head lack oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy life of vanity, which he has given thee under the sun, all thy days of vanity. For that is thy portion in life and in thy labor, wherein thou laborest under the sun. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol, whether thou goest. Right? And so he identifies these particular points about wealth, that it is provided. The Lord identified. He actually, Paul said, if a man doesn't work, don't let him eat. And so that when you have your labor and you are providing for this life, we have to provide for this life, that there is the matter of riches and wealth of which God said that he provides. Matter of fact, when Paul identified in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, that you take note to tell those who stole to steal no more, but rather do what? Do what? Work with your hands that you may do what? Have to give to others. Alright, so you have your life, and then you have some else that you can give to others. Right? So he's not saying that you go to work, you get your wealth, and then you take it and you give it to those that have need. What does that do to you? That'd leave you in need, see? So there's a matter of rational thinking, okay, that's involved. But the point is that the Apostle Paul identified, did you teach them to work? Labor with their hands, they're going to have revenue that comes from it. They'll be able to take care of themselves, and then they'll be able to help others also. And that's what Paul identifies. And so when we find this matter of what is stated within the Scriptures, the writing of 1 Timothy chapter 6, 1 Timothy chapter 6, the Apostle Paul identified, we'll go up to verse, this is usually the one that will set us into poverty. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, which some reaching after have been led astray from the faith and have pierced themselves through with many sorrows. All right, was it the money that did it?
No.
It was the love of money that did it. You know, a poor man can have a love of money just as easily as a rich man can have a love of money. Solomon identified that as money is a defense, right? That if you have a wealth, you have a greater defense than somebody that doesn't in life. And wisdom is the same way. It is a defense. All right, so when we're talking about the matter of worldliness or materialism in whatever fashion of how you might define it, we're not talking about a matter that the Lord says that you are to be, as a child of God, that you are to be in poverty. And that's what happens, and that's what gets in the thought of society, is that, well, you just have too much. Right? You just have too much. Jesus didn't have that much, you know, and you just have that much. And so you get religious groups that have, they take a vow of poverty. Right? That's kind of a misnomer, because they're not really poverty stricken. They still get wages and they do whatever. But we find that in regard to it, God is not saying that you cannot have wealth. Matter of fact, you take Abraham, David, Job, you find all of these individuals, godly men who were very wealthy. And Job, you could read about what all Job did with his wealth. Now, Solomon says that a man that has all that wealth and holds it to himself, that's a whole different issue. And so when we're talking about worldliness, we're not talking about the obtaining of wealth in this life. We find in the writing of the Philippian letter, Philippians chapter 4, when the Apostle Paul had identified of what he received within from the church at Philippi, he said in verse 10, he said, "But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at length ye have revived your thoughts for me, wherein ye did indeed take thought, but ye lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therein to be content. I know how to be abased," which would be lacking, "and I know how to abound," which would be plentiful. I know what it's like to lack. I know what it's like to abound. As a matter of fact, Solomon talked about that principle of days of joy and the days of adversity. You know, the days when you have, the days when you don't. They come together. And so he identifies that in everything and in all things have I learned the secret both to be filled and to be hungry, both to abound and to be in want. I can do all things in him that strengtheneth me. What's Paul's point? What type of attitude and mentality must we maintain in regards to these matters? I know how to do without. I know how to abound.
Right? Whether you have or have not, do the Lord's work.
Do the Lord's work. That in whatever state I'm in, I'm content. That doesn't mean that because you're abased that you're going to stay there. I'm content. I will deal with what I have. I will discipline myself to what I have. But that doesn't mean that I'm not allowed to abound in regard to it. And with that of Philippi, he said, "I know that you had a desire for me, but you lacked opportunity." Right? And so here's a case of where he identifies that point. "I can do all things in him that strengthens me. Howbeit ye did well that ye had fellowship with my affliction. And ye yourselves know, also know, ye Philippians, that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church had fellowship with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but ye only." Right? So in the matter of what they sent, the support that they gave unto him to do the work, you deal with the Philippian letter. What is it about the Philippian letter of where he said that ye did well, that ye had fellowship with my affliction? Where was Paul when he wrote that letter?
He's in prison.
And so, you know, a lot of prisons, not like our prisons, a lot of the prisons in those areas, that whatever you get is what your family brings you. And if they don't bring you anything, you don't eat. Simple as that. And there's countries now that is the case. They'll get a bucket of slop, if you will. But that's about all it is. And if they get anything else, it's because their family tends to them or their family is at charge against them. And if families were at charge against their family that ended up in prison, what do you think that family's going to do when they misbehave? They what? Yeah. You're not going to behave that way because I'm not going to be in charge of you. I will be. And that's what the law required. Anyway, so Paul had identified this matter that they had fellowship with his affliction through that which they provided for him. He identified in verse 16, "For even in Thessalonica you sent once again unto my need." Now here's his attitude. Did he not like what he received? Was he not thankful for what he received? Sure he was. And he commended them for what they did. Now what he said, here's the bigger picture. Paul always saw the big picture. Their association with him financially and helping him in regard to it. He said that I seek not for the gift, but, and here's this not but construction. Here's what Paul saw was the fruits of what they did. But I seek for the fruit that increases to your account. To your account. And the writer in 1 John also deals with that principle that we all look for those opportunities to have fellowship with those that are laboring in the faith individually. Now, we do it collectively, and we think, well, we fulfill our responsibility. Maybe not. Okay. And so we find that in fellowship with others that are involved in the work, the Apostle Paul commends them, but we understand that it's not the money. How much... Do I go there? Donnie's not here. I'm going to go there. Because it's one of them, I don't have a dog in the fight. Okay, so in regard to it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the Apostle Paul talked about his work. He said in verse 3, because there were people charging him not being an apostle, whatever the case was. He said, my defense to them that examined me is this. Have we no right to eat and drink, have we no right to lead about a wife that is a believer? What is to lead about a wife? Okay, you have a wife, you're married. Lead about, she go with you. Do, and she requires maintenance. You require maintenance, she requires maintenance. And he said, don't we have a right to that as the rest of the apostles and the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? Or I only and Barnabas, have we not the right to forbear working? Now, to forbear something is what? Not to do it? Is that what he's talking about? I don't have to do nothing. Right there, the scripture tells me I can forbear working. I don't have to do anything. Sounds like a pretty good job, doesn't it? But he deals with the matter of secular pursuits. Not to be tied up in those secular pursuits. And that's what he dealt with Timothy as far as his work was concerned. He identified that what soldier, here's the reasoning, what soldier ever serveth as his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not the milk of the flock? Well, Paul, you're just talking about physical things. We're talking about spiritual things. We're talking, and that's what he said. Do I speak these things after the manner of men, or saith not the law also the same? For it is written, thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn. Is it for the oxen that God careth, or saith he it assuredly for our sake? Yea, for our sake it is written, because he that ploweth ought to plow in hope, and he that thresheth to thresh in hope of partaking. Here was a matter of the hope. He says that you don't muzzle the ox when they tread out the corn. So what did they have access to?
They had access to what they were.
What they were, the work. They had access to that. They could eat of that. Now he said, doesn't the law say that? What does the law say? How? We're getting off on this. This may give, how do you determine how much you support, provide support for a gospel preacher? How do you determine that?
2 Corinthians speaks about them being equal.
Equal?
To be on the same equality.
Okay.
Support them in a way that they can live as comfortably.
Comfortably? Is that 2 Corinthians? I need that passage. Whatever. We find that Paul said you go back to the law. You go back to the law. What did the law say? What did the law say about that? God's attitude toward the finances, if you put it in that particular regard. How do we know that? Other places that said, well, so much support is what the preacher said. The support is what I need. And someone said, well, I'm not making that much. So they can't make any more than the lowest income in the group. Or, well, that's more than anybody makes. So they can't make more than anybody makes. I'm going to salt your tongue here just a little bit. The children of Israel had the responsibility to tithe. There were 601,730 men, 20 years of age and upward, able to go to war. There were...
603,550.
They what? 603,550. In the able to go to war in Numbers, the first part. In chapter 28, there were 6,100, but even that within 600,000 of them. Let's just go with a 600,000 number. Of the Levites?
Wow.
Of the Levites, there were 23,000.
I was about to say 22,000.
Yeah, good. Very good. 22 or 23,000. Now, the tithe went to the Levites. So you have 601 or 603, depending on whether it's when they first went in or at the end of Numbers, that you have that many. You have 600,000 tithing, and that tithe is given to 23,000 Levites. If they tithe $1 a piece, how much did they make a week or a month, whatever, a year? It doesn't matter. How much did they make? If they tithe a dollar, how much did they make?
If they tithe a dollar per day, per week?
Well, whatever, you know.
If they tithe a dollar a day, then it was $365
a year. If they tithe a dollar, how much did they make?
$10
is what they made. And so 600,000, that tithe, you have $600,000 that come in. They make $10 a day. I'm going to make this short and quick. The priest would tithe the tithe in chapter 28. They would tithe and give to Aaron and his sons for their family. And Aaron, you have Aaron, Hophni, Phinehas, Eleazar, and Ithamar. So you have them tithing the tithe. Do you know those that devoted themselves to spiritual things made 2.5 times what the average or what the others made? They just made $10. 2.5 times. If you miss it 40%, you're still at 1.5 times above that. Now that's God's attitude toward it. That's God's attitude. That's not man's attitude. Man's attitude, they don't do anything anyway. You know. And the poorest of us, we don't make that much. And unfortunately, that is a thought process. Been there, did that. That is a thought process that exists. So when we consider what Paul said, do you think, you know, because you pay your plumber $85 an hour or whatever it is, or whatever the number is, okay, and he provides his tools and he does all of that, the gospel preacher, well, that's just way too much. You know, your plumber's fixing your leaks, and those that are about spiritual, sacred matters are dealing with eternal issues. And that's why with the elders, that you let those that labor the word be worthy of double honor. Bobby's daughter, you twice as much as I would have otherwise. Okay. It's a financial thing. So God's attitude towards finances is, can you have finances? Can you have wealth? Can you have riches?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good. We're moving along here. You can have that. And we find that, and Paul said that if you think I'm just talking about the world, here's what God said. So you find out what God said about the finances, because that's exactly what he's talking about. And the Lord said, a laborer is worthy of his hire. So you don't muzzle the ox that's treading out the corn, let them eat all they want to eat. Now it's going to be the Philippians that they had that desire, but they lack opportunity. There is that. Okay, that falls into the equation. But we get more wrapped up in finances as to what that you have to almost be in poverty if you're righteous. And that's not so. And so when we're looking at worldliness, we're looking at a matter that deals with what Paul said in Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, where he identified the responsibilities that we have within our service to the Lord as far as our spiritual service is concerned. When he said, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. And be not fashioned according to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And so Paul talks about this matter of don't be fashioned according to this world. And we are to be transformed in regard to it. Joshua said, we've dealt with several times this week, he said that you serve who you're going to serve, but as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. That's the point in reference to what we're doing. And whether we're serving the Lord or not does not have reference to the fact of whether we're poor or wealthy. Have an abundance of wealth. There are godly men and women that have an abundance of wealth. And the world will look at them and think that they ought to be, well, if you were a Christian, you wouldn't have all that. You know, you bound to have done something wrong or whatever the case may be. And we see, so when the Lord is talking about or dealing with this issue of worldliness, we're talking about not being conformed to the world within which we live. The writing of James in James chapter 4 and verse 4, here's what James indicated is the issue that needs to be addressed. James 4, 4. Ye adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore would be a friend of the world maketh himself an enemy of God. We hear that phrase. If you look like it, smell like it, taste like it, that's probably what it is. You, with a duck, you walk like a duck, you look like a duck, you quack like a duck, probably a duck. All right. So if there's no distinction in our lives between that of the rest of the world, and we're holding on to this life, we're living as if this life is all there is, then we are at enmity or enemies of God. We have to make a determination as to who it is we're going to serve. The Lord said, you cannot serve two masters. So where does worldliness come from? Worldliness comes from the very point that John made in John chapter 2, 1 John chapter 2, 16 and 17, that the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the vainglory of life is of the world, okay, and not from the Father. So when we're following those pursuits, and that's what, and there's no doubt that you see things you want. Does that make you worldly? No. Okay. Your body needs things. Lust of the flesh. Does that make you worldly? The flesh does it. The lust does. That's the point. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the vainglory of life, which is wisdom. This is going to make me smart. You go all the way back to Eve. That's what Satan appealed to then. Lust of the eyes. She saw it looked good. Lust of the flesh, it was good for food, and it made me wise. Vain glory of life. And so that's the avenue through which worldliness will find its way into the life of an individual. In the writing of Mark, in Mark chapter 4 and verse 18. Mark 4 and verse 18. We have the event of the sower, the seed, and the soil upon which this seed fell. And he said unto them, know ye not this parable? And how shall ye know all the parables? The sower soweth the word. And these are they that by the wayside were the... Excuse me. And these are they by the wayside where the word is sown. And when they have heard, straightway cometh Satan and taketh away the word which hath been sown in them. And these in like manner are they that are sown upon the rocky place, who, when they have heard the word, straightway receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then, when tribulation and persecution arises because of the word, straightway they stumble. And others are they that are sown among the thorns. These are they that have heard the word, and the cares of the world, and the deceitfulness of riches, and the lust of other things enter in, choke the word, and it becomes cometh unprofitable. What do we usually do when we get to the parable of the sower and the soil? What do we usually do with this passage? We usually end up spending our time trying to define what the soil is, you know, what the rocky ground is. And we miss the whole point in reference to what the Lord has to say, because he's identifying this matter of the cares of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the lust of other things. That's what falls under the category of worldliness, that we love the world. And they had these cares, or the persecutions that arose, the tribulations. They weren't able to, they were able, but they didn't endure under those circumstances. And they fell away. And so we ought to be observant of those who come to the Lord and make sure we're doing everything we can that they don't fall in those areas. Because usually individuals, there was a statement made by a fellow in Nevada. He said, and he told them, said, when you obey the gospel, that's the last step you have to take by yourself. Have a good day. Okay. We have responsibilities to one another to make sure that we're assisting one another. And some are weaker, if you will, when they start out than maybe somebody else. And somebody, they usually hit the ground running. But then these problems come up and we need to be there for them, because the cares of the world will enter in. And so you have the cares of the world, you have the deceitfulness of riches, and you have the lust of other things. And people deal with those. People in the world, they're coming out of the world. And when they come out of the world, it's not like a light switch. They've got a lot of training to do, a lot of things that have to change. And they need help. And so this matter of worldliness deals with an attachment to this, where we are now within the flesh. Now, what I want to look at is a matter that deals with the effects of worldliness on the gospel. First of all, we have a positive nature, if you will, within the world within which we live, that there are brethren who will hazard their life for the sake of the gospel. We have in Romans chapter 16, verse 3, of that of Priscilla and Aquila, or Prisca and Aquila, however you want to go about pronouncing them. But we find that they did, Romans chapter 16, the Apostle Paul commends them when he said in verse 3, salute Prisca and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus, who for my life laid down their own necks, unto whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. We find that there's a positive thing of what brethren will do for the benefit of the gospel. And as Paul was concerned, as his work, they were willing to lay down their life for his benefit. We also have that Epaphras, in the writing of the Philippian letter, Philippians chapter 2, Philippians 2 and verse 25, that Paul, once again, he's in Rome, he is in prison. He said, but I count it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. Your messenger and your minister. And that's what he's talking about, those of Philippi. They were concerned about Paul. And so we find that there is a positive side of the gospel, of where individuals are willing to give themselves for the benefit of others, whether they be evangelists, whether they be whatever they may be in regards to their service to the Lord, and they're willing to give their life for them. And that's a pretty serious matter when you're willing to go that far. But it's based upon their faith in their God and recognizing that this world, we sing a song, is not our home. And they're willing to do whatever needs to be done for the benefit of the gospel. On the other hand, we find that worldliness has had some negative effects in regards to individuals in their life when worldliness entered in. In the writing of John, in John chapter 14 and verse 27, And after the sop, then entered Satan into him. Jesus therefore saith unto him, what thou doest, do quickly. What was it about Judas that ended up him doing what he did? What appeal did he have?
Money.
And he was willing to identify the Lord for the money that he received. And the Lord said, what you do, do quickly. Get on with it. Go on and do it. And so there's a case when we have that the effects of worldliness on a negative, that it ended up having the Lord arrested, tried, and crucified. But it came from that seed of that worldliness. In the writing of Revelation, Revelation 21, verse 7, we noted these last night in regards to the matter of the churches on the collective basis. Revelation 21, verse 7. He said, he that overcometh shall inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But for the fearful and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone. When he identified this point in regards to the fearful, to whom did he have reference? Was he afraid? Who's the fearful?
Christians.
The what?
A Christian, sir.
Okay. And so we find that if they're fearful, what are they fearful of? All right, they're fearful that you know, I need to make sure I'm doing what the Lord wants me to do. Right. I'm afraid that I'm not doing what the Lord wants me to do. I'm weak, and I'm afraid that I'm going to be overcome by something. That's the kind of fear he's looking at. He's looking at that fear that is cowardly, that will not stand up. And that's the type of fear that he's looking at in reference to it. We all have fears. Just because you have some fear in your life, that doesn't mean you fall under this category. And so when we consider these matters that he says, but for the fearful and for the unbelieving, that their part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, we find on the negative sense that when we look at the world and we are cowardly and we don't do what the Lord wants us to do because we're afraid of the consequences, of the consequences that will follow if I do something. If I say something, and we have a lot of individuals that are cowardly in that regard, they won't say something, even in a nation where they have no fear of retribution. Or if they do, it's very little. You may have some rejection of somebody, a friend that they no longer have in part with you. But we're afraid how people's going to respond. We ought to be more afraid about how our God's going to respond. Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God unto salvation. And that's what that type of fear of Revelation 21 does. It's one that will shut our mouths because we're afraid of the consequences if we say something. And it's a cowardly thing. And so we find that worldliness will cause that to happen. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10, the Apostle Paul, as opposed to that of Epaphroditus, in regards to his jail time with what he had, Paul said in 2 Timothy, now apparently Paul had been in prison, in the 1 Timothy he had been in prison, he had been released, and now he's in prison again for the sake of the gospel, and while he is in prison and he is awaiting his death, he said to Timothy, give diligence to come shortly unto me, for Demas forsook me, having loved this present world, and went to Thessalonica. A love of the world. That's a negative part of what worldliness will do in our lives. The effect of worldliness on a family is devastating. We find in the writing of 2 Samuel, here's a case with David. And we see the progress, we're all familiar with this, so we'll not get a lot of background of what took place between David and Bathsheba. But we find that in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 2, 2 Samuel 11, verse 2. And it came to pass in the eventide that David arose from off his bed, and he walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. We know the events of what transpired with that of Bathsheba. And so David, verse 4, he sent messengers, and he took her, and she came in unto him, and purified from her, she was, and that's what that bathing was all about. She was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her house, and the woman conceived. And she sent and told David, and said, I am with child. This set in process a great deal of events. David now has a problem. And that is that Uriah is where? He's on the battlefield. So David calls and he has Uriah to come in. And he figures that while Uriah is in town, he's going to go to his house. He's going to go to his wife. And he goes into his wife, and nobody's the wiser in regard to this. But he had more scruples than what David had planned on. And he would not go into his wife as long as his fellow were out fighting. So David says, and I'll appeal to this in reference to this, I'll get the fellow drunk. And then his resolve will be lessened. And he'll go to his wife. And nobody's the wiser. We're good. But even that, he did not do so. And so David constructed a letter. Now all of this is a result of David's worldliness in reference to this. David constructed a letter to be sent to Joab and tells Joab that you take Uriah. And who's taking the letter? Uriah. He doesn't know what's in it. Gives it to Joab. And he tells Joab that you put him out in the front of the battle so that he would die. Joab's going, this isn't good, but he does it. And the battle ensued, and Joab pulled his troops back. Uriah died, but Uriah was not the only one that died as a result of this. And when the word goes back to David about how ill the battle went, Joab puts in there, oh yeah, by the way, Uriah the Hittite is dead. And David says, oh well. Things happen. That's not a quote. Don't quote me on that. But that's the principle of what was there. And that began with his worldliness. But we find that it didn't stop there. We find that in regard to this particular matter, in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 9, that there were some unforeseen consequences to this. Nathan said, verse 7, Nathan said to David, thou art the man. Now, you talked about this fellow that comes in, the rich man, and that he took, not of his own flock, but he took the only sheep that the poor man had that was just in his bosom, he just loved this sheep, it's all he had. And the rich man took it, and he gave it to the one that had come in to eat and drink. And David was livid. Well, he's worthy of death. And Nathan says, you're the man. Nailed him. Nathan had a tendency to be able to do that with David. Knowing what he did, he'd set him up and he'd say, you're the man. Yeah. And so when Nathan said to David, thou art the man, thus saith Jehovah the God of Israel, I anointed thee king over Israel, and I delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. And I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom. And I gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added unto thee such and such thing. If that wasn't enough, I would have given you more things in regard to it.
Wherefore hast thou despised the word of Jehovah to do that which is evil in his sight? Thou hast smitten Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and hast taken his wife to be thy wife, and hast slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword, here's the matter of these unforeseen consequences to this transgression. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from thy house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this of the sun. Who did that?
His son
did that. And we have that Adonai, I believe that was his name, or Adonijah, which one of the eldest that tried to get the throne from Solomon. That he, we know Absalom rose up against David. And then when Absalom's gone, then the next oldest, which Adonijah, the king's identified, whichever one it was, that he now wanted it when Solomon had it. And so Solomon ultimately told him, you behave yourself, you'll be okay. He didn't behave himself, he died. And so we have this, that the Lord said that the sword is not going to depart from your house because of what you have done. What you did secretly, I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against Jehovah. And Nathan said unto David, Jehovah also has put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die. Howbeit, because by this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of Jehovah to blaspheme, the child also that is born unto thee shall surely die. And Nathan departed from the house. We find that whatever the reasons are, except for these unforeseen consequences, that it couldn't be said that David, after he took Bathsheba, that the child that she had belonged to Uriah. And so if that's the case, I don't know if that's the case or not, but we find that as a result of it, there were unforeseen consequences based upon that. We also find the writer of Malachi. We'll look a little bit more at Malachi tonight, but here was a point that Malachi had made in regard to worldliness because it dealt with the men of Israel. Do you recall that when the Lord said and dealt with it in Matthew chapter 19 about the marriage relationship, that a man leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and except it be on the grounds of fornication, that he could not put her away? They were in the habit of doing that. And his disciples said, boy, if that's the case, I'd be better off not to marry. If I can't get rid of her, I'd be better off not to marry. And then, of course, the Lord deals with that issue as well within that context. But the point is that that was something they had a habit of doing within their life. And so dealing even with these priests in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 13, we find that he said, and this again ye do. Ye cover the altar of Jehovah with tears, with weeping, and with sighing, insomuch that he regardeth not the offerings of any more, neither receiveth it with good will at your hand. How were they filling the altar or covering the altar with tears and with weeping? They were doing it by the wives. The wives would come in because he said, in regards to that, verse 14, yet ye say, wherefore? How so? Because Jehovah hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, though she is thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. It's how you treat your wives. And so we find that in regard to that, that not only had they not separated themselves from the women of the land, they were dealing treacherously with their wives. And what would happen, according to some of the historical thing, that these righteous men that go along and their wife had reached a certain age and they see a young woman and that's the one they want, they'd put away their wives. And they'd take what they wanted.
And the Lord said, you've covered the altar with tears and weeping from your wives because you dealt treacherously with them. Worldliness will have a devastating effect upon every aspect of our life. And we find that it was ultimately worldliness that killed John the Baptist. Worldliness. He had told Herod, you can't have Herodias. Violated the law. You can't have it. Now, marriage is something that God allows for most everybody to have, but not everybody. And even some that even though they may have a right to marry, they don't have a right to marry certain people, depending on the condition. That's the case. That Herod's brother, right? You cannot have your brother's wife. And Herodias was
his brother's wife.
His wife. And now she's furious. And her intent would be upon killing. That's how furious she was. I'm going to kill the guy. Well, we find that when John was taken and put in prison, and Herodias' daughter goes in, and Herod's got all these leaders in there with him, and she dances, and whatever it does, and he offers her anything that she, anything you want, she consults with her mother. What do I ask for? And she said, I want the head of John the Baptist on the platter. Well, Herod had made an oath, and for his personal condition, he could not go back on it. And therefore, John the Baptist lost his life out of worldliness. If we have a love for the world, we are at enmity with God. And we need to make sure that we consider all the factors of life within what we do. So how do we overcome worldliness? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1. Here's what the Apostle Paul tells us. And this is what's going to help us in regard to worldliness. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1. For if then ye were raised together with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are upon the earth. For ye died, and your life is hid with Christ in God. We keep our focus upon the things that are above. Matthew 6, verse 33, the Apostle Paul, or the Lord Himself indicated, seek ye first the kingdom of God. Now, if that's within the context of the Gentiles, they worry about what they're going to wear. They worry about what they're going to eat. They worry about the things of life, of what's going to happen. And the Lord said, you seek first the kingdom, and all of these things will be added to you. You will have what you need to sustain life. We know the Hebrew writer, there were some that were, they lived in caves. And the world was not worthy of them. But God provided for them, even in that regard. Might not have been on the big house, but they had what they needed in life. And the Lord said, you seek first my kingdom, and you will have that. In the 119th Psalm, verse 9, here's what we need to consider, especially with the young, but it's going to apply at any aspect of our life. The 119th Psalm, we find that in verse 9, the psalmist said, wherewith shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed thereto according to thy word. With my whole heart have I sought thee. Oh, let me not wander from thy commandments. Thy word have I laid up in my heart that I might not sin against thee. How are we going to keep from sinning against the Lord? Laying up that word in our heart. Blaine and I was talking about that last night. Because it will develop our conscience. It will train our conscience. We know what the Word of God is. And therefore, it will help us to not sin against our God. We have within the Philippian letter, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12, which the Apostle Paul identifies as a responsibility that each and every one of us have as far as our service to the Lord is concerned. When he said, so then, my beloved, even as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who worketh in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Work out your own salvation. Doesn't mean that we have a right to determine what's right, okay? But you work it out. You have a responsibility. You work it out. And we always need to keep that to the forefront of our thought. Where are we before our God? Sometimes it gets pretty fearful. We allow the world to get in too close. What do? We are in this flesh. And we have to continually be mindful of these matters, lest they overcome us. But we can overcome worldliness by keeping our thoughts to that which is above, seeking first His kingdom, and that starts every morning when we wake up. What occupies the mind when we first wake up in the morning? Is it going to be what's set before us, what we have to do, where we have to go, things we have to do? Or do we take that time in prayer before our God and thankfulness for what He's provided for us? The world is out there and we're in it, but we're not of it. And if we are of it, then we can't serve two masters. The writer of 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4, we find John said, "This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith." And faith comes of hearing by the Word of God. That's where it is. We have that knowledge. We need that knowledge. We cannot be acceptable to our God without the knowledge that He has given unto us. Therefore, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15 tells us, "Love not the world." Worldliness. That is the danger that is facing Christians, and you can see it. Sometimes it might even affect us that we get too close to the world. So let us keep in mind these particular issues. Any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to relate to what I said earlier. I was referring to 2 Corinthians 8.
Okay.
Of the giving of the saints.
Yes.
That principle can be applied when we don't choose a preacher to work with us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're very good. All right, you have that within the, and that's what it was with Israel. What was their responsibility in the tithing? What was Israel's responsibility?
10%.
Okay, to who?
The priest. Well, to the Lord.
To the Lord. They had a responsibility to give that to the Lord. And the Lord said, this is where you put it. You go, well, wait a minute. We don't want to do that. Well, the Lord has instructed us as to, as we talked the other day, as to what the collection of the expenditures of where they go and what we can do. And that's where that point is. Well, the Lord has already determined that. Right? But you have that aspect. If you're doing what you want to do, if the desire is there and the willingness is there, the Lord will accept it. But if you give everything that you've got, then you become poor. So there's some rationale in there of what has to be considered. But that's it. You know, if the willingness is there, the Lord will accept it. But it has to be in accordance with His will on what we do and how we do it and why we do it. But in that regard, good point, in that regard, we need to make sure that we love not the world. I appreciate your attention this week and your participation with this. We hope that the week has been of a benefit to you, that you can maybe, if not personally, have these to apply, that you can help others who do need it. That's one of the responsibilities that we have.